When I was a senior in college, I taught coming of age at the congregation where I was a member in Phoenix, Arizona. And we did lots of different activities, but one that sticks in my mind to this day is one that asked us to talk about God. And the first thing that we did as the icebreaker to get into the lesson about Unitarian Universalist ideas about God was one called The God You Do Believe In and The God You Don't. And the first thing that we asked all of my amazing seventh and eighth graders to do was to start describing all of the attributes of the God they didn't believe in. And they had a long list. It took up a whole chalkboard in the coming of age classroom. It was long and it included things like, long white beard, sits in a big chair, up in the sky, old white dude with like lots of hair. And I think my favorite aspect of the God that these teenagers didn't believe in was talks like Shakespeare, which I thought was an excellent summary of the way that God seems to speak to people through the King James Version of the Bible. But then we ask the question, what about the God you do believe in? And that list was a lot shorter and a lot harder to talk about. And these were wonderful, brilliant young Unitarian Universalists. But somehow we had never quite gotten to the language to talk about the God we did believe in. For me, one of the gifts of being raised Unitarian Universalist is that I didn't have to reconcile somebody else's definition of God with my lived experience, with how I knew the world and what I seemed to know about the world. But too often, even those of us who have come up through our congregations, whether as children and youth or being formed into Unitarian Universalists as adults, we sometimes let other people dictate the terms of our conversation about God. We let other people set the parameters, the what's possible or what's not possible in terms of what it means to believe or not believe or believe differently in a higher power. But like I said, one of the gifts of Unitarian Universalism is that you don't have to reconcile somebody else's definition of the divine with your own lived experience. And one of the lived experiences that for so many of us cause tension with, whether it's our own or other people's definition of what the divine is, are experiences of grief and loss. My brother was diagnosed with a brain tumor when he was 25, and he lived with symptoms and treatments and the symptoms of those treatments with varying results for about 6 years. He died in 2016. And the last time that I saw him, I was given an opportunity to say goodbye. And as I sat with him in his apartment, surrounded by all of his hospice equipment, I stared down what so many of us stare down at different points in our lives, some folks more often than others, is that I stared down this endless chasm, it seemed like, of the inadequacy of my ideas about life and death and what they meant. What I wouldn't even go so far as to call answers, but maybe my best guesses, they all fell short. Grief and suffering and loss are often cast as these major characters in the arguments either for or against believing in God. Right? You either hear one side, which says, you know, if there was a God, why do people get cancer? Why do people die in car accidents? Why do awful things happen to seemingly wonderful human beings? Why do people treat each other so poorly? If there's a God, how could all of that be happening? or they get cast in the other direction, right? We hear the only way I could cope with the immense grief of this loss or overcome a major struggle like addiction is through a higher power directing my life, carrying me through. And we tend to hear things in either of those directions. But both of those arguments, either for or against believing in God, make a lot of assumptions about who God is and what they do and how we as human beings relate to the divine. Right? Both of those arguments assume that God is all-powerful and in charge of the full spectrum of human existence, from whether or not you suffer from a long illness or whether or not you get in a fender bender. But what if we could release God from those restrictions, from those ideas about what it means to be the divine? What if God's power could be defined beyond a sense of control or a lack of control? Right? I think as I saw with my coming of age class, when we let others define the divine for us, we miss so much of what's important about how we name and claim our faith as Unitarian Universalists. For me, in my own experience of grief and loss and how it tied in with my sense of who the divine is, the thing that those arguments about, well, if God really existed, no one would suffer, or God must exist because God eased my suffering, is that those arguments miss for me the most important piece, which is that there is so much that we don't know about the why. Well, sure, we can point to a lot of direct and scientifically provable causes for things that we experience in our lives. We can talk about gene mutations and environmental triggers, or the failure of an airbag, or the underlying causes of gun violence in our society, or the risks of doing anything. But the deeper why does life end? And why does it always seem to break our hearts, even when we know that it's inevitable for all of us at some point? To me, the answers to those questions, the answers are beyond the smallness of my human language and comprehension. And we might glimpse them in a few transcendent moments, but for the most part, I confess myself, and I think most of us, hopelessly ignorant about the deeper why. But the work, right, the work of trying to glimpse those moments of comprehension, for me, the way I define that is that I'm seeking to understand myself as part of a story whose author is beyond human knowing. I would describe that I'm looking for God. I'm seeking the holy. I'm seeking to make sense of what it means to be human in relationship to other people and to the divine. I'm seeking for a force beyond me to help transform me into a more fully alive person, a better version of myself. You might frame that search differently. You might frame that search with different language. You might frame that search in a way that doesn't use the word God. But the first sort of piece of the good news of Unitarian Universalism that I want to invite us to witness this morning is that the divine need not take on a particular form or a particular name in order for us to join in the work of making sense of being human. The divine does not need to go by a certain name, look a certain way, have a certain attribute in order for us to declare that we want to work together to understand these human existences that we have and that we're trying to do our best in. Between mystery and the need to breathe. Between mystery and the need to breathe. God, though we may encounter them in nature, does not exist separate from the thousands of years of human history that have known that very piece of riverbank. God, though we may encounter them in the reverberations of a saxophone, does not exist separate from the human lungs, lips, and hands that breathed life into the music. God, however and wherever we encounter them, does not help us transcend or overcome our humanity, but to live more fully into it. This is the second piece of Unitarian Universalist good news I want to lift up this morning. That our human bodies, our hearts, our lungs, our skin, our neurons, are not burdens or tests to be overcome in our relationship with the divine. They are tools, tools to understand ourselves in relationship to this greater story of existence, human and divine all at once. Right? That space between the mystery and the need to breathe. But the caveat that I bring to that blessedness of our human form is that humanity is not always quite so great. Right. One of the great tests for Unitarian Universalism and our assertion that humanity is not inherently given to evil and injustice is that we have to make meaning of a world where we seem to be harming each other all the time. Before I went to seminary, I was a middle school teacher, and the students that I taught were all recently arrived refugees from a variety of places, but especially from Nepal and Bhutan and from the Horn of Africa and from the Middle East. And maybe you've heard the phrase, hurt people, to describe the ways that we pass our trauma along from generation to generation or relationship to relationship. Though I didn't know it before I walked into the classroom, I soon figured out that I was teaching beautiful children who were children of war, who were the children of US imperialism, who were the children of ethnic conflict. I remember one day I was tasked with giving a math exam to a student who was from Iraq and had emigrated about a year prior. And it was a harrowing experience. And at the end of it, mostly for the student, and I think a little bit for me, and at the end of it, I sort of talked to another teacher who had been at the school for longer, and I said, what support can we give this student? How can we help them? And my colleague turned to me and said, you know, he colors pictures of men with guns, buildings on fire. I don't know what we're supposed to do. We didn't know what we were supposed to do. Here, tasked with the education and forming of these beautiful human lives that had been so disastrously impacted. And it was easy to make it abstract, to say these things happened in a different place, a different time, with different people than me. But the reality was that when I dove a little deeper, right, when I felt the higher calling of my Unitarian Universalist faith, right, demanding me to see the ways that my life and my students' lives were bound up together, interdependent and interconnected, I started to realize, right, that the price of the gas that I put in my car every day and the price of clothes I could buy at the mall and the thousands of other small comforts afforded to me as a white person in the United States were wrapped up with the violent circumstances that had produced these beautiful hurting kids that I saw in my classroom every day. And how could I not feel like a failure each and every weekday as I struggled to undo hundreds of years of economic and military violence with 4.5 hours of classroom instruction? Looking back on it, if I had been approaching it from a purely reasonable perspective, I think that I should have either A, just quit trying, or B, abandoned the curriculum and led them in an anti-capitalist uprising. Though sadly, I think that uprising would have been short-lived. The school district did not tolerate them, and I sadly also have lost my union-negotiated health insurance. How could I not feel like a failure? In truth, I was unequal to the task, because the task was, on its face, completely impossible. But what I came to realize is that we undertake impossible tasks all the time. Every day, we seek to raise our children without the biases and trauma of our own upbringings. We work to transform the institutions of this country, founded as they were in the theft of tribal land and the enslavement of African peoples. We imagine a future where no life is treated as disposable by the state, though the state has been an instrument of violence for hundreds of years. We undertake impossible tasks all the time, every day. The reasonable thing to do would be to quit, to just throw up our hands and say enough. But I think I'm here, and I imagine that some of you at least are here because you want to know how we stay in the struggle to find meaning and hope in this world, filled as it is with both personal grief and loss and pain, and the collective pain of harm brought by others, and the places that those two things intersect. For me, I've stayed in it because I believe that I am part of that bigger story. A story that is at least as long and varied as the presence of human life on this planet. And I think I've been able to stay in it even when the reasonable thing to do would be to quit because this is just impossible. I've been able to stay in it because I know that that story is not exclusively written by human intelligence. Right, the poet wrote, "The stuff I need for singing by whatever means is garnered from every thought, every heart that ever pounded the earth, the intelligence that directs the stars, the shapes of mountains, cities, a whistle leaf of grass, or a human bent with loss will revise the pattern of the story, the song. I take it from there. Write or play through the heartbreak of the tenderness of being until I am the sky, the earth, the song, and the singer." Those words have just been settling in my spirit all week long. I am not separate from the story. I am not above it or below it or outside of it. I'm not separate from the intelligence that directs the stars. I'm bound up in it. And being bound up in it means that I have a responsibility to do what I can. And so the final piece of the good news of Unitarian Universalism that I want to lift up with all of us this morning is that the divine cannot be hemmed in, boxed in, or defined by our human restrictions. I mean, that's the first piece, right? Nobody out there can box God in. And that we have a responsibility to respond to that expansive, holy story by working to move with the divine to help us all get free, to help us all flourish as human beings, to help us all have those moments that Joy Harjo described and that Elizabeth Tarbox described, where we know that we are part of something that is moving beyond the edges of our human form. I think of the final verse of the song that we'll sing in a little while. When friends by shame are undefiled, how can I keep from singing? right? When friends by shame are undefiled, how can I keep from singing? And at this moment, I'll offer my permanent caveat about Unitarian Universalism and God beyond boundaries and not listening to other people's restrictive definitions of the holy. Because sometimes we can swing that pendulum all the way over to what I would think of as the corner of believe whatever you want. So if you've swung your pendulum all the way over there, I'm going to invite you to just bring it back. Because we do have what I think of as bowling bumpers to our theology, right? When you go bowling and you aren't quite as skilled as some others, they put up bumpers to help you understand, you know, where the lane you're supposed to be in. And so there's lots of ways that we express our ideas about how the holy moves and shapes our lives and universe. And it's currently sort of formally expressed in our principles and sources in the bylaws of the Unitarian Universalist Association, but it lives in a lot of other forms and places too, and has throughout our history. And from my perspective, they're all sort of summaries of these three ideas: that the divine is equally present in and to each of us, that the eternal fate of one of us is the eternal fate of all of us, and that revelation is not sealed. So, given those bowling bumpers, how might God work on me? That's always my question. How might God work on me? How might God work on us? How might we be transformed by learning our place in the story and advancing the cause of justice and human flourishing? How can we let the divine work on us, allow us to be present to deep grief, challenge us to remain in the fight for justice, and most of all, push us to expand our sense of what is possible? We are not separate from the intelligence that directs the stars. We call it differently, we know it differently. But it forms us, it shapes us, and we must respond in kind.